Welcome to the Beyond Addiction Show with Josh King. This program is designed to help those who are affected by substance use. Whether you are using, trying to stop, or a loved one who wants to help, there are many effective resources, and together we'll explore them and bring you hope. Now, here is your host, Dr. Josh King.
Hello, and welcome back to another episode of the Beyond Addiction Show. I am your host, Dr. Josh King, and today we are talking with Dr. Shannon Sauer-Zavala, a clinical psychologist, a professor, and a trainer, and a co-developer even of the Unified Protocol, one of the newer treatment protocols for treating multiple issues all at the same time. She's going to talk with us about how we can understand multiple issues that are co-occurring for a person, why we should be treating them all together, and how we do that using the Unified Protocol. And this is going to be really, really good for people who find that they have multiple symptoms, multiple things going on for them all at the same time, and have been saying, well, I don't know how I treat all of this stuff all at once. This is a really great way to treat them all. And last week, we spoke with Dr. Lisa Martin on the impact that race and identity have on mental health and on treatment. And I personally found it to be a very powerful episode because these are complex topics and difficult ones to discuss, even for people like me who talk about this a lot. And I feel like Dr. Martin pushed me a lot in that episode to be more thoughtful about how I think about and speak about race and identity. And that's actually just a really good thing. I think we all need to be thinking about this more. It's been, race and identity have really been big news, especially in the last couple of months. And I expect that it's only going to be bigger news in the next few months as we move along through the political process. So this episode is a great way to understand what's going on in these conversations. It's really powerful. I'll go back to it. And before I start talking about today we're going to talk about support networks. I want to put out a small listener challenge. As of this morning, there were 51 ratings on iTunes. And I can't thank you enough for taking the time to give me those stars. I really, really appreciate it. And we need more. I want more people to find out about this show. And that means that we really need to double that number at the very least. So I'm putting out a listener challenge. I want you to rate this show. If you think I deserve 5 stars, give me them 5 stars. If not, still rate it because I want the feedback. I want to know. I want to know what people are thinking. And I want to try to get to 100 ratings by next week. That means 50 more ratings. Well, 49, but 50 more ratings in the next week. So if you're listening to this on an Apple device, please go and give me a rating. And let's see if we can get that number to shoot up. Because the faster that shoots up, the higher likelihood that more people are going to see this show in their feed, and the more likely that they're going to be able to get this information. So let's see if we can get up to 100 ratings in the next week. Today, I want to talk about building a support network. And this is more, we've spent a lot of time on the show talking about things for families and for that family members can do. This is more about individuals who are struggling themselves. And before we go into it, I want to give a disclaimer. Talking or thinking about support networks can actually be really hard for people. As someone gets deeper and deeper into substance use, it's normal that the relationships that they had start to fall off as the substance use picks up. So isolation is really a hallmark of substance use disorders. And that's also in part due to the shame of use and also because of all of the time spent searching for substances, using the substances, and then recovering from the substances. So all of that, the shame that makes me not want to be around people and all of the time spent using and recovering doesn't leave a lot of time for connection. So when we're thinking about this, if you start to feel bad, if you start to feel sad, if you start to feel ashamed, just know that that's really normal and that it's an opportunity for you to say, well, all right, well, if this is an area that feels this not good, then that also means that it's an opportunity to work on fixing or changing my situation. So why am I focusing on building a support network? Well, change tends to work best when you have support. And this is the one area of real solid evidence that we have on AA, is that the community surrounding it, the fellowship that they do, the fellowship aspect, is hugely impactful and powerful. And we have a lot of evidence that shows that that aspect of AA is really, really important and helpful. Still, being around people can be difficult, especially early on in the change process. After so much time isolating and letting relationships falter, it can be really hard to be around people. It can feel awkward to be around people. It can feel awkward at the best of times to be around other people, but especially at a time when I've really let my other relationships disappear, it can feel really awkward to be back in touch with people. And it can also bring up feelings of shame and insecurity. So how do we actually build a support network when we're carrying around all of this other stuff? Well, like I mentioned before, AA and NA, all of the anonymous groups, tend to be really great places to start to build a support network. And if you've never been to a meeting before, I want to kind of highlight what it's like when you walk into one the first time. Because when you're new, people just come up to you and introduce themselves. They are really attuned to who is new here, who's the new face, and asking about it and wanting to be welcoming. Because I think for a lot of people, when they came and everyone was welcoming for them, that was hugely, hugely impactful. So they're trying to kind of pay it forward. And when you're new, they come up to you and they say, oh, are you new here? Can I help you out? Can I figure this out? And can I give you my number? And can I get your number? I want to call you. I want you to call me. I want to have this connection with you because this feels like a great opportunity, not only for you, and I want to encourage that, but it also feels like a great opportunity for me because I get to actually be somebody who then is helping and I'm giving back. And actually giving back is a really helpful tool and a helpful skill for people to be able to maintain their own substance use goals. So it's helping everyone. And so you walk in there and sometimes you're getting like 20 to 30 new numbers. Everyone is just coming up to you. Oh, here's my number. Here's my number. Here's my number. It can feel overwhelming at times. It can also feel really warm and reinforcing. It sets up this idea of, wow, this is a community, a real community, and they want me here and I want to be here. So it can be very, very powerful. So AA and NA is a really nice place to begin the process of building a support network. Now, there is one caveat, and I want to put this out there. Not every AA meeting fits everyone's personalities. There are a ton of AA and NA meetings out there. And, you know, there's lots, many, many other varieties of the anonymous meetings. And there's so many out there and each one is a little bit different. And if you're in a big city like New York City, you have pretty much endless options of them. If you're listening to this and you're in the middle of the country in a small town, you might not have a ton of options. You might not have more than one option. But if you do have more than one option, go and try out a few of them. There are so many websites online that describe what each meeting is like. Check those out. If you have several around them, try them on. This does not have to be a one-size-fits-all feeling. Not every AA meeting is going to feel the same. So see if you can find one that fits a little bit more closely to yourself and what you're looking for from a community. So that's one area that you can build a community. But there are other places that you could build a community that have nothing to do with the recovery community at large, right? Things like volunteering. Volunteering is a great way to connect with other people and to connect with them in a healthy way that you're giving back. I always recommend to people that if you can preferably be at the same place and at the same time each week. that allows you to meet the same people who are there each week, that you get to see the same people over and over again. One-off volunteering opportunities don't necessarily give you that option. But if you get to see the same people over and over again, then you can start to build a connection with them and you start to become a steady presence at that place. And so you're, people are actually like missing you if you're not there. So it's a really nice way to build up a sense of community, and people will notice if you're missing. So it even has some accountability. Hobbies are a great way to meet people. Less so the hobbies that you're doing just in your house, but taking classes, joining a group that does something that you're interested in. All of these things give you an instant group of people with a built-in topic of conversation, the thing that you really like doing. And that could be anything from board games, or Dungeons and Dragons is making like a very big comeback these days. And that's a great way to meet people and to find this. It could be taking cooking classes. It could be baking classes. It could be activities that you like to do. Things, just any kind of hobby that you have, looking around online is a really helpful way to build a little bit of a community. Meetups, apps like the apps and websites like meetup.com, which literally is what it says it is. It's just a place where people say, I want to go to the park today and play Ultimate Frisbee, and I'd love to get people together to do that. And they put up a thing and they online, and people sign up to do it. And it can be anything from going to the park and playing Ultimate Frisbee to people who really love movies and regularly go to the movies together and go to dinner in a movie, and they talk about the movie and they eat dinner. And I've heard of meetups where they're just walking. I've heard of meetups walking through parks. I've heard of meetups where they are knitting. I've heard of meetups where they go to concerts. So many options. And then also social sports leagues, which can be a little bit tricky. A lot of social sports leagues also have a strong drinking component with them, where they encourage people to go out after games. But you actually don't need to engage in that part of it in order to be part of the team or to have fun and connect with your teammates. You could just say, oh, I'm sorry, I can't. You know, I always have something after here. I got to run home after the game. Can't really make it out. But I can hang out with everybody. And when I feel more comfortable, I could even share with them, yeah, actually, I don't drink, so I don't want to go out to that. And it's a nice way to just connect with people on something else. So once you've picked something, see if you can go into it knowing that it's going to be uncomfortable. Go into it saying, all right, I am sure that I might feel uncomfortable. Right? And that's a normal thing. It's not weird of me to feel uncomfortable going into this social situation. I feel that way a lot of the time, and it has nothing to do with isolation in the past. It's just uncomfortable sometimes to go into a new situation. And once you've gotten there, you can say, all right, what coping skills can I use? What coping skills have I learned on the Beyond Addiction show? Or what coping skills have I learned in life? Or what coping skills did I read online? And I'm going to use those not to help me feel better, because it won't really help me feel better, but to help me continue to engage in this situation and to tolerate my uncomfortable feelings. And then third, I want to be ready to step out of my own comfort zone a little bit. I want to be able to say, all right, I gotta extend myself. If I'm feeling like I really want to be quiet, maybe I need to be pushing myself to talk to more people. And maybe you don't want to do that all at once. Maybe you don't want to like jump right to, I'm going to just like go and be the life of the party. I need to take it step by step, but little by little, I'm going to step a little bit more and a little bit more and a little bit more into the discomfort of getting to know that there are getting to know new people or to engage in a new activity. And remember, there might be some people in your world who are really positive supports already. Don't neglect them while you're building this new system. In fact, bringing them in can be a helpful way to overcome the barriers that you might experience, the barriers of saying, oh, it's too awkward to go out there and try this out without having a friend with me. So let me ask this friend who I know is a safe person, who I know is going to help support my goals, and I'm going to take them with me so that I feel more comfortable. So building a support network that helps you to maintain your substance use goals, it's not always easy. But the payoff from it can be really huge because they can really help support you in maintaining the changes that you're trying to make. So I hope that that's helpful. We're going to actually focus a lot more on things that individuals can be doing this season to help make and maintain substance use change and any real behavioral change. All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to be talking with Dr. Shannon Sauer-Zavala about the Unified Protocol. So let's take a break. We'll be back in a minute.
Become our friend on Facebook. Post your thoughts about our shows and network on our timeline. Visit facebook.com/Voice America.
CMC Foundation for Change is a new not-for-profit that is all about families helping families and parents helping parents through addiction from those who have been there. Over 111 million family members worldwide are affected in some way by addiction. CMC Foundation for Change helps give these families hope through support, education, and helpful resources. For more information about CMC Foundation for Change, please visit cmcffc.org on the web. That's cmcffc.org. Now there's a book for families who are looking to help loved ones. Beyond Addiction, How Science and Kindness Help People Change is now available at Amazon.com, available in hardcover, paperback, and on Kindle. Pick up your copy of Beyond Addiction today. If you are a parent or a partner who is seeking guidance in helping a loved one with substance use, be sure to pick up the 20-Minute Guide. This is a terrific resource, and proceeds help the CMC Foundation for Change. Visit the 20MinuteGuide.com. That's 20MinuteGuide.com.
Have you friended us on Facebook yet?
Why not?
Just go to facebook.com/Voice America or search for the keywords Voice America. Once you are part of our Facebook network, you'll receive daily messages about what's happening with our shows, this week's featured guests, and new happenings at the Voice America Talk Radio Network. And you can add your voice to the always active discussions on our timeline. Just go to facebook.com/Voice America or search for Voice America.
This is the Beyond Addiction Show. If you have a question or comment about our show, be sure to send an email to beyondaddictionshow@joshkingpsyd.com. Again, that's beyondaddictionshow@joshkingpsyd.com. Now, back to the show.
Welcome back. And joining me now is Dr. Shannon Sauer-Zavala, a clinical psychologist and a professor at the University of Kentucky and a co-developer of the Unified Protocol, which is what we're going to learn about today. Shannon, welcome to the show.
Hi, Josh. Thank you so much for having me.
It's really my pleasure. I should say that Shannon came very highly recommended from several people here who did a training with her. So I'm just really excited to have you on the show. Shannon, the Unified Protocol, which people refer to as the UP, has an interesting and understanding of how symptoms work when they're coming together and why so many mental health issues happen at the same time for people. Can you talk a little about that?
Yeah, absolutely. So traditionally, when we think about treating mental health problems, we think about treating each discrete disorder that a person might have. So if you have a substance use disorder or an alcohol use disorder, there might be a treatment that's developed just to deal with that. And then if you have a co-occurring anxiety disorder or depression, there are different treatment approaches for those conditions. So if you are like most people that struggle with mental health problems, you have more than one condition. And so it can feel really piecemeal trying to put together a treatment that addresses your full picture. A lot of times people feel not great about the idea of kind of racking up mental health difficulties, right? Maybe I use substances and I also obsessively check and seek reassurance and I'm really down. And it can feel kind of overwhelming to have a lot of these problems going on at the same time. However, cutting edge research suggests that there are really good reasons why people might suffer from different manifestations of mental health issues. So what we find is that people that have that struggle with substance abuse, that have depression, that have anxiety, they tend to experience their emotions really strongly. It's really a biological predisposition, right, to just be emotionally sensitive. And it's not necessarily a bad thing. Lots of people are emotionally sensitive. I would certainly put myself in that camp. And I think that it actually makes me a better therapist because of it. But it's what you do with those negative emotions when they come up, right? So when a person experiences strong emotions and they respond to those emotions with aversive reactions, they don't like feeling sad or anxious or guilty or angry. They might say things to themselves like, I shouldn't be feeling this way. It's weak to have these emotions. This is so uncomfortable. Get this feeling away from me. And that's when people turn to a range of different behaviors that actually sort of fit within different diagnostic presentations. So, you know, somebody might use substances to numb some of the negative feelings that they're having, especially if they're telling themselves that it's weak to feel this way or they shouldn't be having this reaction. People might cut themselves or engage in other forms of self-injury because that's been shown to push away negative emotions really quickly in the short term. People might engage in like extensive double checking or reassurance seeking or avoiding crowded places. Or, you know, in depression, people might start to feel sad or down and they might take a nap because you're not feeling a whole heck of a lot when you're asleep. So across all of these different sort of disorder presentations where you're seeing these sort of characteristic behaviors, the function is to get rid of really uncomfortable negative emotions. And so that kind of, you know, given that there's sort of the same process that's underlying a bunch of different conditions, right? So feeling emotions really strongly, not liking them very much, and engaging in efforts to push them away, instead of, you know, targeting the symptom, so the substance use or the lack of motivation in depression or the avoidance and anxiety. Instead, the unified protocol is aimed at going after those core underlying vulnerabilities that put a person at risk for all of those symptoms.
So can I ask a question? Because one of the things that you were saying before, that reaction to negative emotions, that feeling like, oh, this doesn't feel good, I don't want that. That doesn't feel like it is relegated just to, I don't know, somebody who has depression or somebody who has some kind of a symptom already. That feels like a normal human process.
Oh, definitely, right? I mean, most people, when you're sort of doing something new for the first time and you feel anxious about it, there's that urge to, well, you know what, maybe I'll just cancel plans, or maybe I'll just like stay home today because I have a big important meeting and it makes me really nervous. What ends up happening, though, is when we sort of give in to that really normal, natural urge, it's reinforced, right? Because immediately if I have, you know, a podcast interview that I'm giving and I'm feeling really anxious about it and I decide, you know what, I'm just going to email and say that I can't be there, I'm going to feel a rush of relief. And that's going to be really reinforcing. And that's what's going to make me sort of choose to avoid in the future. And there's really ample evidence that the more we avoid negative emotions, well, they don't go away. They come back more frequently and more intensely at particularly inopportune times. So there's really no like full escape from it. And the short-term avoidance that we choose, it ends up making it worse in the long term.
So in other words, what you're saying is it's not the fact that we feel that way. It's fine to feel like, oh, I don't like this at all. It's that if we keep then avoiding that as a way to, I don't know, solve having it, then that causes other kinds of issues, and we can avoid it with substance use, and we can avoid it with cutting, and we can avoid it with restricting eating or eating more, all of those different things that you're saying?
Right, exactly. And I think too, like the more you avoid something, the more you're telling yourself that it's dangerous. And so the more you avoid feeling, the scarier emotions become. And so that kind of reinforces that notion that I shouldn't be feeling this way. It's weak to have these feelings. And so what we're really looking for is to help patients develop a more sort of willing and approach-oriented stance towards emotions, right? So to work on those, I shouldn't be feeling this way, get this feeling away from me sort of like attitude. And that in turn trickles down to less of this knee-jerk, push it away reactions.
Mm-hmm. So is the unified protocol really about, not to oversimplify, but about being able to be, I don't know, comfortable with being uncomfortable?
Yeah. I mean, I think that's a really great way to summarize it. You know, experiencing emotions, the ups and downs that are just a really normal, natural part of living life, right? I mean, you could probably avoid feeling negative emotions if you never left your room.
Right. If I never go outside.
But to have goals, to strive for them, to have relationships, even functional, happy relationships. I know earlier you were talking about having a support network. Well, you know, 90% of having a support network is great, but like even in the best relationships, you have disagreements and that brings up negative emotions. So these fluctuations in the way that we feel, that's normal and natural. And many people can sort of ride that wave of emotional experiences without being like, this is terrible, get it away from me. And it's a skill though. So we can also cultivate that in people who may have over time really solidified that view of negative emotions as problematic and should be avoided at any cost.
Yeah, I speaking of relationships and sort of the struggle that comes along with that, I've done a lot of couples work where people say, well, it shouldn't be this hard. It should always be, you know, like feeling good. And that's why I'm really struggling with this. And I say, well, why should a relationship always feel good? Relationships are hard. They're hard work. They don't always feel good. And that really throws people for a loop.
Totally.
I guess we're just really built to seek out that kind of just, I want to feel good all the time.
Yeah, I mean, I think that makes sense. I mean, humans are, you know, if we want to sort of like, you know, kind of boil us down, I mean, humans are pleasure seeking and seek to avoid pain. I mean, that is, you know, in many senses adaptive, right? Sort of avoiding painful, like physically painful situations and moving towards things that make us feel good. You know, and I think moving away from things that cause fear, that's adaptive as well, right? So if the house is on fire and you're feeling scared, it's adaptive to get away from that, you know, and the fear then goes down once you avoid. But it's taking a sort of a more, like when that avoidance becomes habitual and across situations that, you know, it's not necessary to avoid, that's when we start to solidify this view that it's the emotions themselves that are dangerous. And we get stuck in this pattern of engaging in behaviors that make things worse for us just to avoid the negative emotions.
Okay. So I'm certainly on board with this idea that, right, we have to experience uncomfortable negative emotions in order to live life, right? That makes perfect sense for me. But there are so many different evidence-based treatments out there in order to treat each one of these discrete issues. Mm-hmm. Why create a new one? What does the unified protocol bring that the others don't necessarily have?
Yeah, I think that's great. And I think it's worth saying at the outset too, that a lot of the skills in the unified protocol are not brand new. They are sort of taken from the more traditional disorder-specific approaches and kind of have the shift in orientation so that they're about the experience of emotions more broadly. So, you know, if we're sort of to contrast it with a treatment for social anxiety specifically, in social anxiety treatments, you are trying to help the patient learn that relationships and public speaking, like those situations, aren't dangerous. Whereas in the UP, we're focused much more on the broad experience of emotions themselves, that emotions aren't dangerous. And that understanding of emotions generalizes across not just one problem, but many problems that a patient has that sort of function to avoid negative emotions. So a lot of the stuff that's in the UP, the skills, and I'll talk about those in a minute, they're not necessarily new, but the orientation is a bit different. Now, the idea for creating a new treatment that incorporates some of the skills from other treatments really, really speaks to the limitations of a disorder-specific approach. So there's research that suggests that if you are if you're getting mental health treatment and you're not in a really specialized clinic like that is billed towards providing empirically supported treatment, chances are you're not necessarily getting evidence-based care that's been supported by research and science that backs it up. And that's a really sort of depressing.
That's thing. Awful.
Yeah. I mean, it's really scary. And the reason for this, though, is that clinicians in practice are pretty overworked, and that there's a different treatment for every single disorder in the DSM, which is sort of our book of diagnoses. It's a training burden for clinicians. It's impossible if you're seeing 8 patients a day, 5 days a week, to be up to speed on every single iteration of a cognitive behavioral treatment for each anxiety disorder and depression. It's a really tall task. The other issue is that most of our patients meet criteria for more than one disorder. And so when you're a therapist and you're talking with your patient, you're kind of in this awkward position of having to choose which single disorder manual is the best fit for your patient who might have 2 or 3 or 4 diagnoses. And so how do you choose, especially if the patient is describing all of their difficulties as similarly interfering? And so the idea with the UP is that what if we had a protocol, right, that instead of going at like playing whack-a-mole with the different symptom presentations, we focused in on the core underlying deficits. And if you go, you know, to mix my analogies, right, if you go right for the heart of the beast, could that lead to simultaneous symptom improvement across a range of different clinicians? So this solves the therapist training burden because you need only learn one protocol to be able to provide evidence-based treatment to nearly everybody on your caseload. And then it solves the issue with patients with comorbid conditions or more than one disorder at once, because one protocol can simultaneously treat symptoms across disorders.
Well, that sounds almost too good to be true, that we can, like, how come nobody has come up with this idea? Like, let's have one that can treat all of this. Does it actually work?
Yeah. So that's a great question. We've been doing randomized control trials, which is sort of like the gold standard way to evaluate a treatment, for several years now. And kind of our very first sort of attempts to quantify whether the UP works were comparing the treatment to a waitlist control, so people getting no treatment. And in fact, as you might expect, getting treatment with the UP leads to large reductions in depressive and anxiety symptoms. And those changes are much bigger than people on the waitlist. Most recently, and we're really excited about this, we conducted what's called an equivalence trial. So instead of looking for differences between treatments, we were hoping to see that this transdiagnostic diffuse UP approach was just as good at targeting the primary diagnosis as the manual that was developed just for that diagnosis. So in other words, is the UP just as good as treating panic disorder as the manual that was designed for panic disorder? And indeed, what we found is that the UP led to equivalent symptom reduction with less attrition. People were less likely to drop out of the UP than out of the disorder-focused cognitive behavioral therapy condition. So it works.
That's cool. Those are some good results there.
Yeah, so they're great. We're so excited about them. And then we've also done some pilot work sort of extending the UP beyond these most common conditions of depression and anxiety. So, you know, I've been really interested in using the UP with folks with borderline personality disorder. We've used the UP with alcohol use disorders. I've been collaborating with some groups that have that are using the UP as the behavioral treatment in their Suboxone clinics. So people with opioid addictions, let's see, what other eating disorders? We've used the UP in inpatient eating disorder hospitals and seeing really promising results across all of these disorders.
That's great. So walk me through this treatment protocol. What are the components of it?
Yeah, absolutely. So the Unified Protocol is a cognitive behavioral intervention. So like I said, a lot of the elements are going to sound pretty familiar. We start out when we're talking about sort of the core skills that we think are really going after those aversive, avoidant reactions to frequently occurring strong emotions. So we start out with our understanding emotions module. And here the idea when I'm working with a patient is to help them understand that this goal of trying to push away emotions, first of all, it's not realistic. You're not going to be able to really do that. And second of all, that it's not an adaptive goal. It's not something that's really helpful. And so I do a lot to help them sort of understand why emotions are helpful, right? Fear keeps us safe. Sadness helps us to withdraw and process a loss. Anxiety helps us prepare for a stressor that might be coming up in the future, right? We wouldn't want to get rid of these emotions. But sometimes, even though emotions are trying to communicate really important information to us, they can feel really overwhelming. So also as part of this introductory part of the UP, we talk about breaking emotions down into more manageable parts. What you're thinking, what you're feeling physically in your body, and what you do or what you feel like doing in response to strong emotions. And then with regard to the behaviors, really early on in treatment, we are talking about the long and short-term consequences of those behaviors. So in the short term, you might leave a party because you're feeling really anxious, and that might make you feel better, right? What are you getting out of it? You're getting the short-term relief. But in the long term, all that does is tell you that parties and small talk are dangerous, that you're awkward, and you're setting yourself to be to continue to feel those strong emotions in the future. And so that's the buy-in. I'm really trying to get patients to understand that they're doing things that work like a charm in the short term. So of course they're doing them, but that are screwing them long term.
So far it sounds very similar to like acceptance and commitment therapy.
Yeah, right. And I think that makes a lot of sense because, you know, in acceptance and commitment therapy, the mechanism, right, that the treatment is going after is called experiential avoidance. And experiential avoidance is another way to say aversive avoidant reactions to emotions, not wanting to experience emotions. I mean, I think that that's really good, right, that these different sort of leading treatments for these problems think that the psychopathology, the depression and the anxiety, the addictions, right, that they come from the same core underlying problem. Like this convergence across different sort of leading groups gives us some confidence that we're targeting the right thing.
Right. It's kind of like if somebody says the same opinion as you and you're like, ah, yeah, all right, that feels good. Like we're sharing the same thing.
Right. It's a sort of a similar understanding of what causes some of these problems to occur with sort of a different style for approaching. I think ACT is a great treatment and people, you know, I've used it. And I think some people really like the mindfulness. It's very pretty heavy on the mindfulness and the values-based goal setting. And that piece, some people really resonate with that. I've also had patients that, you know, want a more sort of structured, more traditional cognitive therapy approach. And so the UP would probably be a better fit in that case.
Okay. So I think I interrupted you. So you were about to say, I think the cognitive behavioral piece of it.
Yeah. So we sort of set the stage with the psychoeducation, with the goals and this understanding emotions. And then we do have a mindfulness module. And I wouldn't consider the UP a mindfulness-based treatment, right? There's some treatments where you just meditate a ton and that drives the change. Here, mindfulness or this non-judgmental, present-focused attention is sort of a lens through which we can look in on those emotional experiences. So we've just sort of come to the shared conclusion that emotions are adaptive and we don't want to push them away, but that's all we've done. So how do we look at our emotions in a different way? And so we do a little mindfulness training to help patients kind of orient towards their emotional experiences in a more approach-oriented way. And then I mentioned those three components, right? Thoughts, behaviors, and physical sensations. Well, then we have a skill, a module. We spend one or two sessions talking specifically about each one of those modules. So we have a cognitive flexibility module. We really lean into the flexibility. Some people have had experiences with cognitive work where their therapist might say something to you like, gosh, like that's a maladaptive thought. The way that you're thinking is really causing you to feel all of these things. Let's change the way you think. Well, we're still changing the way people think or like encouraging them to come up with different interpretations, but it's a little kinder and gentler, right? So there's a lot of like bringing in the mindfulness. Well, it makes sense that you would have that reaction in this situation given the life experiences that you've had before. But hey, I wonder if there might be some other ways of looking at the situation and really talking about like mental habits that people make and how emotions can drive some of the some of the thoughts that we're having.
So that's that feels like that could be a tough sell for people not to say to challenge their thoughts. That feels like something that we've been indoctrinated with since youth. Mm-hmm. Right? Oh, you have that thought? That's not a good thought. Why don't you find evidence that that's not true?
Yeah. So we really practice sort of noticing the thought, noticing how the, like, trying to understand why that thought might be coming up. We don't spend a ton of time on that, but it is sort of this recognition that this is part of your emotional experience. And when you're feeling a strong emotion, you tend to kind of think in these habitual ways, like your brain is trained that way. There's nothing wrong with you. That's the way that brains are supposed to work. It's a mental shortcut. We do the same thing when we go to the grocery store and we try to make a decision about, you know, what brand of peanut butter is the best one to buy. We're like, oh, like Jif is best. And we just pick it. And it's a mental shortcut. We're not sitting there weighing the pros and cons or the validity of that thought. And so we do the same thing in emotional situations, right? When somebody doesn't text us back and we immediately go to that place of like, oh, everybody must be hanging out without me. Well, that's another sort of mental shortcut. Your brain is just trying to like appraise all of the information that's coming in your day-to-day life. And so it just makes these habitual interpretations. And so the idea is to not beat ourselves up for making those interpretations. It's just to notice that's the pattern that we've fallen into, and then to try to be a bit more flexible about it. Well, could there be some other explanations for why the person didn't text you back?
Mm-hmm. Okay. So instead of trying to, find a fight the thought, you're saying, all right, can we kind of roll with the thought?
Yeah, I think that's a good way to think about it.
Okay. So after that,
then we move into our behavioral focus module. And here there's a lot of assessment. We sort of go back to those long and short-term consequences, and we try to encourage, instead of engaging in behaviors to avoid emotions, to try to do some approach-oriented activities. And here we try to help people think about all the ways that they avoid so that we can start to make some of these challenges happen. So sometimes avoidance is really overt, like, I just don't interact with that person anymore, or, you know, I don't do that activity, or I don't take courses that have a public speaking component, I just don't do it, or I don't go to parties. Or I don't go to crowded movie theaters. We call that like overt avoidance. But in fact, actually, people engage in other more sort of sneaky or subtle ways of avoiding their emotions. So maybe you go to the party, but you keep your shades on the whole time, or you're texting the whole time so that you don't feel awkward. Mm-hmm. These behaviors, you know, or like another good one would be like pre-gaming or drinking before you go out. You know, you still go, but you're doing something to take the edge off the emotional experience. And again, that's reinforcing the notion that emotions are dangerous, that you can't just feel your emotions, right? Because why else would you have to take the edge off a little bit?
Right. I do want, my wife always points out, she knows when I'm anxious at a party or at a social gathering, because she calls it the Josh show. I just talk the whole time. And I fill up all the space. So that's another kind of, not an overt avoidance, but
a more subtle thing. Right. And, you know, one of the reasons I really like the behavioral module is that for every patient that you have or every person that you talk to, there's like sort of an idiosyncratic personal way of avoiding emotions that's unique just to you. So I think that can be really fun to uncover some of these things and then encourage people to try some different things.
Yeah. It highlights, because as soon as she has said that to me, I now notice, oh, man, I'm doing that. I must be more anxious than I thought.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yep. All right. So are there other components of this, or?
Yep. So just two more. So the next piece is the third piece of the three component model, which is understanding and tolerating physical sensations. So for a lot of people, physical sensations when you're experiencing a negative emotion are almost like the most aversive part of it. You know, in OCD, having your heart racing so much when you have an obsession, can really increase the likelihood that you're going to engage in a compulsion. Or for people with substance use difficulties, that when they're feeling really stressed out and they're feeling that in their body, that can really increase the urges or the cravings that they might feel really physically. And so the way that we sort of approach this is exposure to those physical sensations kind of divorced from the emotional context itself. So right in session, I'll have people do fun things like breathe through a coffee stir while holding their nose, or spin in my desk chair, or hyperventilate. And these bring on the symptoms of an emotional experience. You're not in the midst of an emotional experience, so you don't have to also worry about the fight with the partner that sometimes causes these things. It's just the physical sensations themselves. And what we find is through repeated practice, like I have you hyperventilate over and over again, at first that's pretty distressing, but over time, those physical sensations become boring. They become old news. You learn that they're not dangerous. And then when you experience those same physical sensations out in the world as a function of like having a situation that brings up a strong emotion, they're just not as provoking. And so you can spend more time thinking about how you might interpret a situation differently or engage in approach-oriented behavior instead of a avoidance behavior.
All right. And right? that's very neat. I can't imagine sitting in a therapist's office doing that. But I do some of those kinds of exposures and people are always like weirded out by it. And the last component?
And then the last piece really puts it all together. And so we do something called emotion exposures. And here what we're doing is encouraging people to make a list of the situations that bring up strong emotions for them that they're currently avoiding. And then we ask them to practice their mindfulness, their cognitive restructuring, their avoidance of avoidance, all of these things in the context of real life, relevant to them situations. Because it's one thing to sort of like know the skills, but it's another thing to really put them together and practice them in real life. And, you know, when I'm talking about exposures, I mean, there's no better way to show yourself that emotions are not dangerous, that you're not scared of them, than to deliberately bring them on yourself. It's sort of like, you know, it's the best way to show yourself, this isn't a thing. I can experience these emotions, to take control.
That sounds very powerful and empowering for a person. Shannon, you are awesome. Thank you so much. You have lived up to the billing that everybody had. This was a really cool exposure to everything that the Unified Protocol has. How can people find more about you?
Sure. Yeah. So as you mentioned, I am a professor at the University of Kentucky. And you can go to my website, which is...
Gotta look it up right now.
I know, I have to look it up because it's brand new. I actually just started at the University of Kentucky and moved from Boston University. So my website, which is really focused on treatment outcome research, testing treatments to make sure patients are getting the best care. So it's tips, tips.as@uky.edu. So that's where you can find out more about my research. And really soon, one of my big hopes here in Kentucky is to begin doing treatment outcome trials with the Unified Protocol. And so basically what that means is that people would be able to get treatment at no cost, these cutting edge, gold standard cognitive behavioral interventions for anxiety and depression and other common mental health problems at no cost as a function of participating in this research. Sort of secondary to that, my research will be sort of headed out of what we're starting called the Center for Emotional Health, and there locals will be able to get this evidence-based treatment.
Wow, that is an amazing service that you're offering for free to people. So congratulations, Kentucky. You just got a real, real gold star there. That's awesome.
Thank you.
Well, Shannon, thank you so much for coming on. I've so appreciated having you here, and this has been great and informative.
Well, thank you so much. It was my absolute pleasure to chat with you.
Right, we'll have to do it again. All right, we're going to take a quick break, and we'll be back right after these messages.
We'll be right back.
Become our friend on Facebook. Post your thoughts about our shows and network on our timeline. Visit facebook.com/Voice America.
Now there's a book for families who are looking to help loved ones. Beyond Addiction, How Science and Kindness Help People Change is now available at Amazon.com, available in hardcover, paperback, and on Kindle. Pick up your copy of Beyond Addiction today. If you are a parent or a partner who is seeking guidance in helping a loved one with substance use, be sure to pick up the 20-Minute Guide. This is a terrific resource, and proceeds help the CMC Foundation for Change. Visit the 20MinuteGuide.com. That's 20MinuteGuide.com. CMC Foundation for Change is a new not-for-profit that is all about families helping families and parents helping parents through addiction from those who have been there. Over 111 million family members worldwide are affected in some way by addiction. CMC Foundation for Change helps give these families hope through support, education, and helpful resources. For more information about CMC Foundation for Change, please visit cmcffc.org on the web. That's cmcffc.org.
Have you become a member yet? Sign up now to become a member of Voice America. It's always free and easy. Plus, you get to take advantage of some great member benefits. Get unlimited access to millions of hours of on-demand content across all of our channels. Keep track of your favorite episodes, shows, and hosts in your own customizable library. Find out what shows you might be interested in based on your favorites. Plus, you get insider access with our newsletter. Membership gives you more. Sign up at voiceamerica.com and click register at the top right.
This is the Beyond Addiction Show. If you have a question or comment about our show, be sure to send an email to beyondaddictionshow@joshkingpsyd.com. Again, that's beyondaddictionshow@joshkingpsyd.com. Now, back to the show.
Welcome back, and thank you to Dr. Shannon Sawyer-Zavala for that really enlightening information about the Unified Protocol. And what I really like about knowing about these things is that it now gives you as the consumer some real information to be able to go in and say, gosh, Unified Protocol, like I've never heard of that before. I feel like that would be really helpful for me just based off of what I heard. So now I know someone else who I can go talk to. And I know that there's something that I can say to my therapist, hey, have you heard of this? What about it? Let's talk about this. And, you know, maybe they've heard of it. Maybe they haven't. Maybe they just have a tiny bit of knowledge. And you want to say, I'd like you to get more knowledge, because the goal of this show is to have to create educated consumers, informed consumers, so that you can go and say, you know what, provider out there, I'm demanding a higher level of care for myself. I'm demanding that you are taking care of me. And so I need you to be as informed as I am, and I'm learning all of this stuff, so now I want you to. And there were so many parts of that Unified Protocol I could just hear coming from ACT, from Acceptance and Commitment Therapy, coming from Dialectical and Behavior Therapy, from DBT, coming from the different protocols for social anxiety. There are so many different components there that I could just hear how it fits together and saying, wow, that one's evidence-based. Oh, that one's evidence-based. That one's evidence-based. Like I could see how they all fit together in this really nice blend. So it's a really cool idea, this Unified Protocol. I kind of wish that I had come up with it and put it together, which clearly I did not. But I'm glad to know about it more. I'm glad to know more about it. And I'm glad that you all know more about it now. So you should definitely, especially if you're in the Kentucky area, this is a person who you should be going out and looking for, because Kentucky, there's not a ton of great treatment out there. And that's not a dig on Kentucky. You're like most of the country. There's not a lot of great treatment. And so to know that she's out there and she's providing this and is going to be providing it even for free to people says, you're about to have a super valuable resource, and now is a really good time to get in touch and to say, hey, I heard this. I heard this on the Beyond Addiction Show, or to send it to somebody who you know and say, hey, I heard this, and this would be really good for you and your family. And to get in touch with her and say, when you open up, I'd like to be part of this because what you're doing feels like it would be really helpful for me. And that's how we become informed consumers and that we take in charge of our own healthcare. So if you have any questions for me, you can find me on Twitter at Doc Josh King. You can find me at Facebook at the Center for Motivation and Change. You can find the Center for Motivation and Change at motivationandchange.com. And if you've got questions, comments, find me at any of those places. And you can shoot me an email at beyondaddictionshow@joshkingpsyd.com. I'm mixing up my handles. And well, to next week, we're going to have a really cool interview with Dr. Mark Lewis, who's going to be talking all about a learning theory of addiction. So taking the way that we think about addiction and shifting it a little bit to understand it more as something that is learned versus a disease model or versus a moral model. So that's a great interview and I'm looking forward to it. So till next week, I'm Dr. Josh King, and I will talk to you soon.
Thank you for joining us this week for the Beyond Addiction Show. Join us again next Thursday at 1 p.m. Pacific Time, 4 p.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Health and Wellness Channel. Until the next program, we wish you encouragement and hope.
Thanks again for listening to the preceding program.